Welcome to the UFO File Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the UFO Files. I'm Jerry Pippin here in Oklahoma this week. In Secaucus, New Jersey, we have Larry Dickett.
Hello, Jerry. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Now, Larry, last time we did the UFO Files, we stopped about, we actually got to Montana, but I think we skipped some other states to get to there. So we have some more sightings to report. And I know you've been looking around at some of the interesting emails that we've been receiving as well.
Right.
So it'll be a good show, but it's going to be a dynamite show because I want to go over this sighting that started you off on this odyssey of a lifetime of UFO watching.
Yeah, that's certainly quite a story. And incidentally, last night I spent a good 2 hours. I got the real treatment, you know. Some of these UFO shows or paranormal shows, they get these guests on and they run them through the ringer for 3 or 4 hours, right? Well, I got the treatment last night. I was on 2 hours with Mary Sutherland, and she was recording a show, and the show was about me and about the Jerry Pippin Show and how we got together and the whole thing and a little history about myself. And that was one of the first things in the interview. She says, well, when you were young, did you have any UFO sightings? And, I knew what we were going to do here. So I sort of said, well, yeah, I did. But we're going to do it on our show this weekend, so I'm going to have to beg off on that, and I'll give you a little teaser about what happened, but you're going to have to tune in to our broadcast to get the full story. So that's what we're going to get into right now, is what happened to me back in 1958 when I was 16 years old.
And that was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? And you were... out of an area where, I guess, if anybody's familiar with Tulsa, where Oral Roberts University is, or close to there?
Yeah, just north of the site where Oral Roberts University is currently.
But back then, it was an empty field.
Yes, cow pasture.
I guess it was empty, there were cows there.
Cows, right. And
What were you doing out there to begin with?
Well, that night was August the 12th. And I know the date because we were out there, a group of us was out doing a watch on a meteor shower. And it's the Perseid meteor shower, which occurs every year on August 12, 13. Best time to see things is after midnight. And that year particularly, it was a really great... meteor shower display, a good time had by all. And not only that, something happened that no one was expecting.
Now, you were 16 and school had not started yet, so you were entitled to be out at midnight.
Yeah, and we because we had actually had some I'd done this a number of times on my own with smaller groups, like 3 or 4 or 5 people. But we did have included in the group some kids that were somewhat younger, they were like 10 through 15. And so we did have a couple of adults in attendance as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because, 10-year-old kids, you don't want to keep them out all night. The parents worry about them. So we had a couple of adults along with 10 kids, including myself. And
So what happened exactly? You're out there looking for the meteor showers.
Right. Well, this happened, it was rather coincidental too, is the peak of the meteor shower occurs at approximately 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's because the constellation Perseus is basically almost straight overhead at that time, and that's when you actually see the most meteors, is when the constellation which the shower emanates from is basically overhead, or if it's closer to the horizon, at least it's, you know, due south from you or due north from you, whatever. Perseus just happens that, you know, at the latitude Oklahoma's at, is that it's not that far from passing almost due overhead. So the peak was around 2 a.m. Now, at the same time that we're all, you know, excitedly watching all these meteors, I just happened to be standing up. I look to my southeast, and I, you know, I mean, it's very dark out there. You're in the middle of the field, but, you know, there's some ambient light, so you can, you know, even at night. And, you know, as you look to the south, you could see trees and whatnot. There's some small hills that are south of the site we're speaking of, in the south part of Tulsa, and those hills have trees on them. So, I mean, you know, it's sort of like you could see that was darker than the night sky. The night sky was nice and clear and full of stars. And I looked to the southeast, as I said, and I saw this fairly bright light that was moving along, you know, at basically treetop level. And it was moving from the southeast sort of towards the northwest, and perhaps several miles south of where we were located. And I just looked at it for a minute, and there were a couple of other people there that were fairly close friends, and I pointed this out to them, and I said, you know, I had a feeling, and I do, that this is true, I had a feeling earlier this evening, you know, even before coming out here, that something strange was going to happen tonight. You know, you get those feelings, right, Jerry?
And basically, that's pretty common with UFO sightings.
Right.
I mean, people seem to have premonitions.
Right. And that's exactly the way I felt. I knew going out that night, I said, you know, something weird's going to happen. And not scary. You know, it wasn't that I was afraid or anything. It's just something really strange and exciting is going to happen tonight. And so when I saw this light, I said, you know, this must be what I was thinking was going to happen. It's going to happen. And I pointed it out to several people. And so there were several of us who were watching this light. Some people seemed to not be terribly interested, you know, making an assumption, well, you know, it's a plane or something, and why worry about it? We're here to watch meteors. And they continued to do so. But as the minutes passed, the light came closer and closer until it was about a mile away, still approximately the same height. I would say it was approximately 50 feet above the ground. You know, the lighting configuration became more visible in terms of you could see that there were three lights. And it was a white light, a red light, and a green light. Now, isn't that convenient? Because, immediately you say, plane, right? Or, at the very least, helicopter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 1958, you know, helicopters flying around at 2 o'clock in the morning would be a most unusual event.
Yeah, especially in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Right, because at that time, most of the helicopters, you know, throughout the United States, were military. There were no news helicopters. There were no emergency rescue helicopters. And very few, except the very, very rich, had their own private helicopter. So if anything, the probability would be military. Military, one helicopter, 2 a.m. in the morning, not terribly likely, right? And there is no Air Force base, right, you know, that close to Tulsa, number one.
That is true, and especially one that would be flying helicopters.
Right, or Army base for that matter. So, that having been said, you know, it's sort of like this, and also the speed of the object, is it was moving so slowly. Now remember, I mean, this was, we saw it when it was several miles southeast of us, and it took, oh, it must have taken at least 10 minutes before it got closer. So it's moving very, very slowly. And an airplane could not have moved that slowly, you know, no matter what the color of the lights. So that was immediately eliminated. And this is what we talked about last night, the escalating hypothesis.
Yes.
That's exactly this train of thought. So plane was eliminated by behavior.
Yeah, we usually, and not as educated, call it the process of elimination.
Right.
Alternative thinking.
Right. And, well, the other terminology is more, with it. Current escalating hypothesis.
I'm impressed.
Right. So, at any rate, we had eliminated the possibility of it being a plane. The next thing was, could it be a helicopter? All right. Well, the lighting configuration of a helicopter is very much different from a plane. They are required to have the same type of running lights. In other words, a white light or green light and a red light. But they're located, generally the red and green are located on the runners, on each side of the craft, because there's no wings. And then you have your white light is on the nose. So, and I think also helicopters have a flashing red light on the top underneath the blades, right, Jerry? That's my recall.
Yeah,
I haven't seen them at night.
Yeah, I think so.
Right. So, at any rate, the thing continues to get closer, moving very slowly, until it's approximately, I would say, 100 yards away at most, and at that point we could see the three distinct lights. They were not bright, not like searchlights or very intense light sources. They were pretty dim, actually. And the thing that we noticed is that even we could see the lights, and we could see that they were rotating about some center. In other words, the red, green, and blue would move, red, green, and white would move in a circular fashion, rotating. What was the shape of the craft? Could we discern that? And the answer to that is perhaps some of the people in the party could, but I, quite frankly, have no recall of what shape it really had. I made some assumptions based upon what I was seeing. Is it three lights in a triangle, right? Is that it could have either been a triangular shaped craft that was rotating, or it could have been a disc-shaped craft that was rotating that had three lights on the bottom of it. Could have been either one. Could I actually see the craft against the night sky? You would think that you would be able to, because the night sky, with the starlight and everything, there's a lot of ambient light there, and any object that is opaque is you should see you should see at least a black shape there, right? As a matter of fact, I didn't really notice, and is it, I sort of got the impression that it was blacking out the sky in a certain position, but we kept noticing that the three lights kept rotating around and around some center. And as far as what was in that center is, I think it was due to the orientation of the craft. It was probably thin enough that that any outline would have been perhaps difficult to really discern.
Now, this is back in 1958, and the way you're describing this, it seems like it was only yesterday. So this made quite an impression on you.
Yes, it did. Yeah. Made the biggest impression on me of any UFO that I saw in my whole life, including the one I saw at Fort Lee in 1985. I mean, that was impressive, but this was a sighting of much longer duration and many other strange events happening, which the other one was just a visual sighting from a distance.
Now, we're going to get into the details of this Tulsa sighting when you were a youth, but the Fort Lee one, was that a triangle or a saucer, or could you tell?
That was a boomerang-shaped
A
craft
boomerang.
that had five lights on the front leading edge of it. And the description of it, I found out a year after I had made the observation. I purchased a copy of Night Siege that was written by Dr. Alan Hynek about a year before he passed away. And in there's a chronology of all of the Hudson Valley sightings that occurred between 1983 and 1986 across upstate New York, New Jersey, northern New Jersey, Long Island, and southwestern Connecticut. And this was over a period of 3 years, and it was laid out in chronological fashion, included a sighting at the Indian Point power plant in upstate New York. A UFO was hovering over the power plant. All the personnel of the plant saw it. It was like 5,100 feet up in the air, hovering over the power plant. Didn't cause any power disruptions, but it was just sitting up there. And eventually it moved off, and that's really all that happened. But my particular sighting was in 1985 during the summer. And so I'm reading through Dr. Hynek's book and get to that point in time in 1985, and there is a description of my sighting.
That's
It's
amazing.
exactly the same thing, boomerang shaped, five lights in the front. And the path of the object was from somewhere in upstate New York, coming down close to the Hudson River. Passed over Alpine, New Jersey, Tenafly, New Jersey, Englewood Cliffs, Fort Lee, which is where I lived at the time, and then made a 90-degree turn and took off over the Hudson River, crossed Manhattan, crossed the East River, and went out on Long Island and ended up out in the middle of Long Island, going out to sea in approximately the same area where TWA Flight 800 crashed many, many years later.
Did this boomerang make any noise?
No, none at all.
Well, let's get back to the sighting in Tulsa, the one that made all the big impression on
Right.
you.
We took a little break there.
Because basically,
Fast forward.
we're talking about 1958, and flying saucers had certainly been talked about in UFOs. I mean, we had the big deal in Washington, D.C. back in 1952.
Right.
And that made the headlines in many papers, including Oklahoma papers. So you being an intelligent lad interested in science, I'm sure you were aware of UFOs and
Oh,
flying
quite aware.
saucers.
In fact, my interest in UFOs began with the Washington sightings in 1952, and the fact that it was in all the media. And I went out and bought a pocketbook edition of Kenneth Kehoe's famous book on,
Project
his investigations.
Interesting. You're listening to the UFO Files of Jerry Pippin and Larry Dickin. We're talking about Larry Dickin's first, I guess it really was your first, I started to say major, but it's really your first UFO sighting, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the first one that I actually saw.
And you've seen three or four since then.
Right. And so at any rate, I, that's when my interest started, was in 1952. And that's when I started reading up on the subject and looking for things. Actually, Jerry, I have to take that back. That wasn't my first sighting of what you would call a UFO. It was actually my second sighting. My first one occurred when I was approximately 14, perhaps 13 years old. I think probably 10, I might have even been 12. And this was something that...
What was the lightness?
A lot of things similar to this were occurring at about that time. This is between 1952 and 1956. There was what they call green fireballs that were zipping through the skies over the Southwest. I'm speaking of Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, up into Kansas, and it's like, you can say, well, these are like big green meteorites or something. Well, is if you saw one a year in that whole area, you might say, yeah, that was just an oddity. It was a meteorite of some sort. But these were like occurring day after day, week after week, year after year. And people were seeing these all over the place.
You know, a lot of the people who are listening, of course, are not as old as us, and so they don't remember that time. But in the 50s, there were quite a lot of UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm.
And they were reported.
Right.
Let's get back to your little sojourn with the UFO there in South Tulsa. Okay, the lights were close to you by now.
Right.
You and the 10 other youth were out with a couple of parents looking at the meteor shower, and you saw the lights coming. It took about 10 minutes for it to get there.
Right.
You can't tell what side, what it was, whether it was round or triangular, but probably one or the other because of the lighting configuration.
And the fact that it was rotating.
And,
yes.
And no, no noise?
Absolutely no noise. And as the craft made its closest approach to our group, and by that time, everybody in the group was standing up staring at this. In other words, people who had been perhaps a little skeptical that something strange was going on quickly got their wits together, and everybody there agreed that this was something unusual. Not everybody was even aware of the concept of UFOs or what they might be. Certainly as aware as I was, but everybody recognized that it was something highly unusual. It was not an aircraft. It was not a helicopter. It was making no noise. The lights were moving in a circular fashion. And as it got approximately 100 yards away from us, and could have been less, perhaps even 50 yards, it stopped.
Just hung there?
It stopped and just hung there.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point.
Now, were there... You said that you were out in the open field, so there were cows around and things like that.
Right. Well, we're not quite to the cows. Uh-huh. But at the point at which it stopped, and all of us are staring at it. One of the people who was standing next to me, and you know, we all of us had flashlights, right? And one individual had not only a flashlight but a slightly larger lantern type flashlight, you know, with a bigger lens in it. And this individual says, well, I'm going to shine my light at this thing and see what happens. And immediately, within my own mind, you know, talking about telepathic experiences during UFO sightings, within my mind, a voice told me that this person should not do that, and that I would, you know, everybody was to remain calm and do not approach. Don't come any closer. And that was very clearly communicated in my mind to me. I didn't make it up. It's just like a voice was talking to me. You know?
You didn't actually hear a voice, though.
Not a voice in the sense of like I can hear your voice. A voice in the sense like you hear your own mind, you know, when you're thinking.
Yeah, okay, I got you.
I mean, you know, you think in words, mm-hmm. All right? It's a voice, and you recognize it as being your voice, okay? This was like that, except I recognized that it was not my voice. It was somebody else. And it says, you know, don't shine any lights, don't come any closer, is no one will come to any harm, you know, stay calm, and do not approach any closer. We made that very clear.
When this was all over, did anyone else hear those voices or get those warnings or feel those feelings? Or
yes,
did you talk
a couple
about
of other people in the group said that they felt the same thing, yes. Not everybody in the group reported that, but several people within the group did report, you know, hearing something in their mind telling them to stay away. No harm will come to you, but stay away. And so I, after hearing this, I told the guy next to me that was going to shine the light. I said, I don't think that'd be a good idea. You know, why don't you just not do that? And rather, I mean, he was not much different in age than I was, so he, hypothetically being a kid, could have said, well, you know, what do you know? I'm going to do whatever I want to do. But he didn't, surprisingly enough. He complied, and he did not shine the light. So after that, within seconds, the craft is hovering there, and all of a sudden, a light comes out of the bottom of it. A beam of light. White light. And you couldn't see the point of origin. You just saw the beam. So that meant that the craft must have been, you know, parallel to the earth, and we couldn't actually see the bottom of the craft. You could just see the light coming out of the bottom of the craft, but you couldn't see any opening or anything. And at the bottom of the beam was a cow, the very same cow that had been in the pasture all night with us, and we had heard this cow had a cowbell tied around its neck.
Yeah, which was pretty common back in those days.
Right. And, you know, it was a little annoying sometimes, I think, ding-donging all night long.
Well, you just think if you were the cow.
But at any rate, you know, I mean, it would certainly indicate movement on the part of the cow. You know, every time the cow would move around, the bell would ring. And so the light came on, shone on the cow, and at that point, the bell, like, stopped, cold, no more ringing. And the cow, you could see, you know, you could see the cow in the light, and it was perfectly still. It was as if it were frozen. It could not move. It was paralyzed. And for that reason, the bell wasn't going to ring, because the cow wasn't moving. Now, that the light shone on the cow for perhaps, I mean, this is strictly a judgment, a lot of years to really remember accurately, but I would say for probably approximately a minute. And also during this time in which the craft had made its closest approach to us, and even before the light came on, is we noticed another event that's very commonly reported in UFO sightings. And of course, if you saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you saw the same type of behavior in the movie. You remember when the craft was hovering over the stars, pickup truck, or not pickup truck, but it was a repair truck. He worked for the power company, and he's sitting there at a stop sign, and the craft comes over, and the big bright light shines down. And right before the light came down, is you heard all of a sudden complete silence. Before that, he was stopped. He heard the crickets in the night, you know, the night insects. And that same thing happened to us. You know, we were out in the field there. It's summertime. You're going to hear night insects, crickets, and whatnot.
But no noise when the light came on.
Like a minute before the light came on, all noise in the area ceased. You could hear a pin drop. And that's a very commonly reported event when you have a really close encounter. So it's like you're encased in a zone of silence. Right. And the same type of, it's almost like you're there, everybody's there that's in the group, but like, it's like the rest of the world just stops. And, you know, being 2 a.m. in the morning, of course, you know, if there'd been any cars driving by, the nearest road was about a quarter of a mile away, so if there'd been any traffic at all, we would have certainly noticed it, but there were no cars driving by. But that's not unusual. Now, if this had occurred perhaps at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night and we were out there, there probably would have been some traffic, and that would have been another unusual occurrence. Typically is that everything seems to stop. People report they're on a road, there's a lot of traffic, and then they get in a dark area and all of a sudden there's no more cars. A UFO close encounter occurs, sometimes an abduction, and during that period of time, no cars, no people other than themselves. So that's not uncommon, and the zone of silence is something that's always recorded with people who have very close encounters with these craft.
How long did the spotlight shine on the cow?
Approximately a minute. Okay. And as I said, the cow was basically paralyzed, frozen, didn't move at all. Then the light switched off, and when the light switched off, the craft immediately began to slowly move off towards the northwest, away from our position. It never shone the light over on our group. Just on the cow. When it turned it off, it started to move away. And as it moved away, Jerry, and the light was off, the night noises, the crickets, the frogs, etc.
They all came back.
All came back, and the cowbell started ringing again. In other words, the cow was moving again. Now, subsequently...
There's more to this.
Oh, yeah. The craft moved off towards the northwest, towards the Arkansas River. We were approximately, I guess, about a mile and a half or 2 miles away from the river down there in that part of town. And the craft started to move northwest towards the river, and it got about a half a mile away, and then all of a sudden it made a turn back to the east, and there was a group of houses approximately a half a mile or three quarters of a mile north of where our location was. And that was basically the south edge of Tulsa at that time. And it was, you know, it was a group of homes. And that was sort of like where the town
ended.
Stopped
right,
at that
right,
point.
Right.
And I would say we were just a little bit south. We were approximately 73rd Street, and these houses were up at about 65th Street or something like that,
mm-hmm.
62nd, somewhere in that neighborhood. So the UFO travels towards this group of houses that we could see. Once it got to the houses, the light from the bottom came back on again. And you could see it was like doing a searchlight thing. The light traveled over the sides and the roofs of these houses as if the craft were looking for something or someone. And this went on for a couple of minutes. The craft is just hovering and moving very slowly over the houses, and this light from beneath it is moving back and forth. And I said, you know, I couldn't resist at the time. I said, well, I wonder if people have their window shades closed or whatnot, or they're going to, there's somebody looking in at them there. And so that took another few minutes. Then the light went off. The craft turned around, went back towards the west, towards the Arkansas River, and then proceeded north until we lost sight of it. And that whole period for the sighting was, I would say, approximately 30 minutes.
Now, this was well before police helicopters in Tulsa.
Oh, yes.
And there were no helicopter noises.
No, there was no noise at all.
And of course, we don't know why the police would be looking at a cow to begin with. So,
right. Well, I mean, you know, for 1958, all of our concepts that would certainly be something that you would run through your mind today about what is this object is, you know, you would think police helicopter would be one of the first things that would come to the mind, because police helicopters do have these bright xenon lights underneath the undercarriage that they use to shine down on the ground when they're out looking for a criminal who might be on foot. And you've seen that in movies and on TV.
No, you see it in person if you live in an urban area.
Right. But the difference between that kind of a light and the one we saw is that you know, that flares out. It comes from a point underneath the helicopter, and it's a cone of light.
So you're saying this light did not behave like a light pattern. It was straight, like a straight
it
column.
It was a straight cylinder up and down. Yeah, there was no flaring of the light source. Also, it was not that blue-white xenon color. And, of course, xenon lighting did not even exist in 1958, number one.
What was it? Was it pure white light or what?
It was almost, I would describe it as being pure white, yes. No tinge of blue or yellow or red or anything, just white.
Well, a very interesting sighting, Larry Dickin. Appreciate you sharing that with us and our audience tonight. I guess we better get to the sightings. Time is flying. I've got an email here at jerry@jerrypippin.com from somebody in Ohio, and they say they've seen a crop circle in the last couple of days.
Well, there certainly have been a number of them formed up there over the last several months. So this is a new one, huh?
Well, it's in Western Union. Union. Let me look at my email and see.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really make it out here, but it's in Ohio, and there's not much information about it, and there is a town here, but you're going to have to talk about it while I focus in on it.
Okay. Well, as I was stating, there's been over the past few months a number of crop circle sightings in Ohio, and
yep.
I know we've gotten some of that information from Mary Sutherland, who's got some of that stuff posted out on our website.
This is in West Union, Ohio, where I have no idea where that is, and it's
either.
Basically a couple of lines. It says, Jerry wanted to know that there is news out of Ohio on crop circles. There's one been spotted at West Union, Ohio. And there's another sentence there, but as most of our listeners know, I have a little vision problem, so it takes me a little while to look at these things. I think it does say where it is in the state, but it's impossible for me to tell you at this moment.
Right. Well, it's not going to be too many more weeks, and when there's not a crop season, circle season's going to be over.
Yeah, it's the southern part of Ohio. I had to get my magnifier there. Well, now, we left our sighting report last hour, the last time we did this, with Montana, but we skipped, I think, if I remember correctly, from the Midwest of Montana, because you wanted to close out with something interesting.
Right.
From a state that we normally don't get a lot of reports from.
And this is true. Montana and Idaho don't seem to have that many reports that make it, to our sources. It does not mean that UFOs are not seen in those states. Really what it means, mostly, is the fact that those states have very low population densities, for the most part. And, if there are no people there to observe, you're not going to get many sightings.
That's a good point. And as we mentioned before, George Filer, who we get the bulk of our reports from, is there in New Jersey where you are. And
right.
Then, of course, Peter Davenport's out in Seattle. So, and then there we have MUFON offices, of course, that report things around the country. And people can report those sightings to us directly at jerry@jerrypippin.com. And you can follow our sightings report as we talk about it on our website by simply clicking on the UFO section. We have a text link there from our audio section where you can go right over and follow what we're talking about. Where are we going to pick up at?
Well, actually, what we did was we skipped everything out west last night except Montana. And so that's where we're going to pick up tonight is we're going to start in Arizona. We have a report from Phoenix, and it states that at about 7:12 p.m. on October the 13th, the witness saw lights while flying over the Indian reservation. Not specific as to which one that is, but I'm sure there's one close there, and thought that they were probably searchlights coming from the casino. Well, I guess, casinos and Indian reservations seem to go together today. So that makes some sense. That's a good possibility that they're seeing searchlights. As they got closer, he saw two faint balls of light that were rotating. One moved down while the other was rotating up. They were very faint but large in diameter and were heading northwest. They made no noise and had to be in the atmosphere. I mean, the meaning of that means that, they had to be something real and solid that was up in the air. It wasn't like a light projection of some sort. And there weren't any clouds, probably, at this point either. And the witness says, I called a friend who was a pilot for America West who was checking at Sky Harbor Airport to see if there might have been, anything flying out of there at that particular time that might explain it.
Okay, an interesting report from Phoenix. Lots of activity in Arizona.
Right. Tempe.
Which is right next to Phoenix.
Right. Today at my local restaurant, the Muse Cafe, an employee, Jessica, claimed she saw a UFO at 2 a.m. on October the 14th near downtown. She was driving her car when she and a bunch of other potential witnesses were also looking at the object while she was heading home. So whatever it was, multiple people saw it.
In Tempe, Arizona.
Right. Now we're going to take a sighting from Alamogordo.
Can't go back to New Mexico.
A little backwards, and then we'll go out to California. Yeah. Alamogordo. Jennifer Brown Jacobs reports, I talked to the junior high school science teacher that said several kids from his class had seen lights that bounced vertically and horizontally and seemed to zip around at around 900 feet in altitude and jump around in a small area. They would fly up and down, brighten, dim, and then brighten again, move right and left, and then hover and repeat this whole performance for several hours. We were told that the town of La Luz was named for this light by the Indians and later the Spanish. I guess La Luz means the light.
Maybe so.
Also, phenomena called Duros that are very scary and very big are being reported near El Paso.
Now, one more about, I don't know anything about Duros. What is that?
I am not aware of what that is.
It says it's big and scary. What do
and
they mean?
Scary.
What do they mean?
It almost sounds like, either something in the Bigfoot realm or perhaps the Chupacabra realm. It sounds like something living, big and scary. Sounds like it's alive rather than being an object.
Yeah, it certainly does. We're going to have to check into that. Folks, anybody know? And how do you spell that? Duros? D-U-R-O-S?
D-U-R-O-S.
Wow.
It's obviously something, Hispanic in origin. It may be some legend from Mexico, or it may be a legend amongst certain tribes of Southwest Indians. It's not clear to me what the origin is.
Yeah, we're going to have to check into that. Maybe somebody out there knows. They can email us and give us some information. At jerry@jerrypippin.com.
Yeah, you might want to check that one out with Nancy in Sonoma.
Yes.
She may be familiar with that.
Yeah, and Sedona, not Sonoma. Sonoma's in California.
Wrong state, wrong town.
Yeah, in fact, sorry, speaking of Nancy, she told me there were some sightings in Jerome last week, too, which is up in the mountains between Flagstaff and Sedona and Phoenix. So they're having lots of activity in the Phoenix, Arizona area.
Right.
Okay, let's and New Mexico, and then now we got the Duros in El Paso, and in California. I don't know if they're seeing anything because of the smoke, but these reports probably came in before the fires started.
Yes, they did. Yeah, and usually reports that we get in here that we're speaking on are anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks old. Occasionally they're up to a month old, but because people take their time sometimes in reporting a sighting. They'll be hesitant to report, and then they'll think about it a while, and then they'll finally decide to do so, and then they go looking for a place to report it to. And with all that time passing, it can be several weeks before we get the report.
Yeah, and we were talking about Nancy in Sedona. That's Nancy McKinney. She's going to, she's volunteered to help us line up the people to interview and kind of be my assistant when we're out at Sunset Station on the 14th and 15th of November for the big crash retrieval UFO conference, which has just about everybody from Linton to Moton Howe to Bud Hopkins and
right.
Stanton Friedman, and talk to the Mr. Wood about it all, and he seems to think it's going to be a great conference, and they got a great speaker for the banquet, I know.
Well, Jerry, I hate to tell you this, but our time is up, We had a couple of sightings in California, but people are going to have to go out to site and read them. And we have to wrap it up real quick here.
Okay, well, we will wrap it up then, and they can check those California sightings. Were they just sightings of disc and lights or what?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks very much, Larry, for another interesting UFO report, especially for your little testimony.
Okay, thank you, Terry, and have a good
you
night,
too.
And we'll see you next
Watch
week.
Watch out for those flying saucers.